Next week, a Food and Drug Administration Advisory Committee will consider whether to recommend approval of a new emergency contraceptive pill. The drug, which is already on the market in Europe, can prevent most pregnancies up to 5 days after unprotected sex. That's 2 days longer than the only drugs currently on the market here. But as NPR's Julie Rovner reports, abortion opponents plan to fight the approval.
Here we go again. A major fight is gearing up over whether the U.S. should join Europe in offering a drug called Ulipristal. Paul Fine is medical director of Planned Parenthood of Houston and Southeast Texas. He says there's a need for a new emergency contraceptive that's longer acting than the current drug most widely in use called Plan B.
There's more time for a woman to decide that, hey, maybe she is at risk and maybe she ought to do something about it and get it done. And Ulipristal is just as effective between 4 and 5 days as it is, you know, in the first couple of days.
That's not the case with Plan B, which can only be used for 3 days after unprotected sex and whose effectiveness declines the longer a woman waits. Fine, who oversaw the clinical trials of Ulipristal here in the U.S., says the new drug, like Plan B, acts by inhibiting ovulation, in other words, preventing the woman from releasing an egg. No egg, no pregnancy. But it does it even better than Plan B does, he says.
The day before ovulation, Plan B is no more effective than a sugar pill. But the new drug, Ulipristal, that we're talking about is highly effective even the day before expected ovulation, when the fertile time is the highest for a woman.
Preventing ovulation is no problem for abortion opponents. They're worried about what happens if a woman takes the drug after an egg has been released and presumably fertilized. Donna Harrison is president of the Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists.
It prevents the fertilized egg, the embryo, from implanting in the uterus. And if the embryo has already implanted, it will destroy the embryo. And those mechanisms are identical to the parent drug of Ulipristal, which is RU486, otherwise known as mifepristone.
That would be the abortion pill. The anti-abortion group Americans United for Life has raised similar concerns in its filings with the FDA. Miley Smith is the group's staff counsel.
This drug should not be classified as an emergency contraceptive like Plan B. It is nothing like Plan B. It is the next generation of RU486.
But Paul Fine of Planned Parenthood, who also teaches obstetrics and gynecology at Baylor University, says the critics fundamentally misunderstand the way the new drug works.
It is not an abortion drug, as being alleged. And in fact, in the dosage it's being used as a single pill, there's no data whatsoever that this causes abortion.
In fact, said Fine, during the trials for the drug, a few women did get pregnant because they had already ovulated, meaning it was too late for the drug to work.
And if ovulation has already occurred, then the chance of fertilization in that particular cycle is 20%.
That's the same as it would be letting nature take its course, and the same as with Plan B, proving, he says, that neither drug causes abortion and that even emergency contraception, while highly effective, isn't 100%. But that doesn't end the complaints from the anti-abortion group. They also have concerns about the new drug's potential safety. Those will be aired when the FDA advisory panel meets next Thursday. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I am Ira Flatow. The Cassini mission to Saturn has been giving scientists a peek at parts of the solar system that they really never have been able to observe before. And one thing they've been looking at closely is Saturn's moon Titan. And in looking at the amounts of chemicals like hydrogen and acetylene on Titan, what they're finding doesn't quite fit with what they expected. And one explanation, and I emphasize one possible explanation, could be that something might be alive there. But before we stop the presses and look forward to aliens landing, greeting us there, let me introduce my guest, Jonathan Lunin. He's an interdisciplinary scientist on the Cassini mission, a co-author of one of the papers that's looking at hydrogen levels on Titan, and a professor of planetary science and physics at the University of Arizona in Tucson, currently at the University of Rome in Italy. Welcome to the program, Dr. Lunin.
Thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us, the headlines are screaming all about possible life on Titan. Is that a little premature?
Screaming headlines are premature. The notion that we have some interesting data on the chemistry of Titan, one explanation for which might have something to do with life, is probably a better way to put it at this point in time.
Give us an idea of why there is that possibility.
Okay, so to give you a very brief overview of Titan, you think of a planet somewhat like the Earth, but instead of water being the working fluid of the climate and the seas, we have methane instead on Titan because it's very, very cold, being so far from the sun. And methane exists in liquid form as lakes and seas in the northern hemisphere. It exists in the atmosphere, and it forms clouds and rains. These are all things that have been discovered by the Cassini-Huygens mission. What Cassini has also found is that methane is broken apart by sunlight in the very upper atmosphere, by ultraviolet light, in much the same way that water is in our own stratosphere, but at a much higher rate. So that, in fact, methane, all the methane in the atmosphere should be destroyed in a time that is small compared to the age of the solar system, about 10% of the age of the solar system. So the fact that we see any methane on Titan today is very interesting. It means there's a source in the deep interior. But one of the products of that chemistry, acetylene, which instead of being carbon and four hydrogens is two carbons and two hydrogens, we expect to see in large abundance on the surface. And the paper that I was involved in found that it was actually not present in large abundance. In fact, we didn't see it at all, although one of the instruments on the Huygens probe, which landed on Titan, did see small amounts. One of the products of acetylene chemistry itself, benzene, has been seen on the surface in the data from the Cassini orbiter. At the same time, hydrogen, which is another product of this methane chemistry, as the methane is broken apart by sunlight, hydrogen is formed. Some of it escapes off the top of the atmosphere, but the rest we expect should form a relatively constant background gas. But instead, another paper based on Cassini data shows that hydrogen seems to have a sink at the surface. There's something, some kind of chemistry that is removing the hydrogen. So one possibility, because in fact hydrogen should be relatively inert, is that there's a very active chemistry. There's some kind of catalysis going on at the surface where acetylene and hydrogen are being recombined to form methane. That would solve part of the methane cycle problem, and it would explain the relative absence of acetylene because it's being used up and the sink of hydrogen near the surface. Now, can this be done by chemistry in the absence of life? Yes, it can be, but it requires a catalyst, because although this reaction releases energy in the end, the combination of acetylene and hydrogen, it requires some energy to leap over the usual activation energy barrier we're familiar with in chemistry. Mm-hmm. So a catalyst of some kind would be required. And in fact, Chris McKay and Heather Smith in 2005, before any of these data were available, had a rather speculative paper on acetylene eating life that would combine with hydrogen, and they made some predictions which are just really what we see qualitatively in the Cassini data.
Acetylene eating life forms, you just said.
Right, that's right, that there would be some form of biology that would have to exist in the absence of liquid water, because liquid water is not stable at the surface. Mm-hmm. It would have to exist in liquid methane and its sister molecule ethane, because those are the liquids at the surface, and that the metabolism that they would undergo would be the consumption mm-hmm. of acetylene with hydrogen to regenerate methane. So, that process produces enough energy to sustain methanogens on the Earth. But again, this is only one possible explanation.
Right.
Might also be plain old chemistry.
Is there any other way to pin this down further? Could there?
With Cassini, probably not. One of the difficulties about trying to detect life, as we say, by looking at metabolisms, is that metabolism is chemistry. We had this problem with Viking on Mars, where there was an experiment where water was added to the Martian soil to see if there were bugs that would begin to metabolize with the aid of the water. And sure enough, there were surprising chemical reactions, mm-hmm. which in the end were finally determined to be abiotic, although there's still a few investigators who don't believe that explanation. Mm-hmm. So intrinsically, looking at the chemistry that life might do to generate energy doesn't really tell you whether life is there. You've got to go there and actually
right.
identify life forms. We're not going to do that with Cassini.
No. And so this is not an if this is a life form, and this is not something that breathes oxygen because it's not there, correct?
Right, although, you know, the breathing, I mean, most life on Earth doesn't breathe oxygen either. The majority mm-hmm. of cells on the Earth are bacterial and archaeal cells that mm-hmm. like to do fermentation. The essential ingredient for life on Earth is the presence of liquid water, not oxygen, but liquid water, because that's the medium of our cells and that's the medium in which all of the biopolymers function. On Titan, there is no stable liquid water. It's just too cold. And so, again, one would be postulating, and I say postulating, a form of life that could exist in liquid methane and ethane. One, at the moment, doesn't know how to construct such a form of life, even on paper, because we have no experience with that kind of biology. But there's nothing a priori that would rule it out.
You just haven't been creative enough.
I guess that's it. Human beings aren't smart enough to you know, inductively create a model of another form of life. Although I have to say that Steve Benner, an organic chemist in Florida, has gone farther than anyone else in identifying possible bonding mechanisms and compounds and so on that type of life might in fact be composed of. But again, these are really speculations, and one would have to eventually go back to Titan and sample in the lakes and seas to actually test for life.
And we have no mission to do that.
We have no mission to do that. There are various proposals. Of course, Cassini-Huygens itself, which has been probably far and away among the most successful planetary missions in terms of number of discoveries in the Saturn system and on Titan, will continue until 2017, and will get a much better insight into the climate and chemistry, and that will help us with all this. One can imagine missions, and these have been thought of and may be proposed to NASA, where you simply land something like the Huygens probe instead of at the equator in one of the northern lakes, and you carry chemical instruments to sample and look for compounds that might be indicative of life forms. That would be the test. But many years in the future, of course.
Mm-hmm. And so this is just one of the possibilities, but a possibility because it could be possible of what's going on the surface there.
It's the one attractive thing about the biological hypothesis is that it explains three things at once: the sink of hydrogen, the dearth of acetylene, and also the relative lack of the primary product of methane chemistry, which is ethane. However, you can explain all three of these with separate mechanisms abiotically. So let me just offer one quickly. There is a catalyst that we're not aware of at the surface that is fixing the hydrogen with methane. The acetylene is just converting to plain old benzene abiotically. We have evidence for that. I mean, that's something that, in fact, we see in some of the Cassini data. And finally, the ethane, after being produced by methane, is simply being buried in the crust. It's percolating through the icy crust of Titan. That set of hypotheses requires no life whatsoever. And in fact, given the fact that an extraordinary explanation, which would be a biological one, requires extraordinary evidence, one really ought to focus, I think, on developing the abiotic explanations and trying to test those.
That was Carl Sagan's famous quote.
Yes, indeed. I paraphrase Carl exactly, and I think he would agree with that. And I'm sorry he's not here now. We all miss him, in fact, because he contributed so much to the science of Titan while he was alive.
Yeah. So we can't advance this anymore, except that it's a theory. I mean, there's no way to move it forward, even as a scientist, I guess.
I think we can, and I hate to use this phrase, which puts everyone asleep, but we can collect more data. And, you know, Cassini will be making many more flybys of Titan, so we'll have an opportunity to take more spectra with the VIMS instrument. This is the spectrometer that found the benzene and the dearth of acetylene, and it's much more mapping for that instrument yet to come. The SEERS instrument, which is in the mid-infrared, should get us more measurements of hydrogen. And I think that essentially by getting more of this data and developing a clearer picture of Titan as a working world with its methane cycle, we probably will be able to narrow down, I think, whether the abiotic explanations will work or not. Yeah. That's what we have to do. It's just slogging through the science.
Now we've got the moons of Saturn to add to the moons of Jupiter, if possible.
My own bias is that the moons of Saturn are very promising. We've talked about Titan. Let's briefly mention Enceladus, which has a plume fed by geysers at the surface. That plume is water ice, but methane and ammonia and other organic compounds are coming out as well. They've been measured directly by Cassini.
All right, John, I'm going to have to leave it at that one because we've run out of time.
But that was good to talk to you, Ira.
We'll have you back. We'll talk about the other moons and the possibilities. This is all fascinating stuff. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
My pleasure, Ira. Thank you.
You're welcome. Jonathan Lunin talking about Titan. We're going to change gears and talk about food allergies. So stay with us. Tell us about food allergies when we come back after this break.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
I'm Robert Siegel, and for soccer fans, the long wait is over.
And here comes Shabalala. He's got a chance here. My goodness. What a fantastic goal for South Africa. What a way to open the scoring in the 2010 World Cup.
In workplaces around the world today, productivity fell sharply as the World Cup got underway in South Africa. The first match was between South Africa and Mexico, and we just heard the first of two goals that were scored. The result was a 1-1 tie. Our own sports commentator, Stefan Fatsis, is in Johannesburg, and Stefan, describe the scene for us.
Well, I was watching the game in a square, Mary Fitzgerald Square in the Newtown neighborhood of Johannesburg. They had a giant screen set up. There was sort of a party atmosphere. Everyone in a yellow South Africa jersey, wigs, construction helmets painted yellow, face paint. I saw a great sign, "Feel it, it's here," which seems to be one of the slogans for the locals in the game. And the biggest cheer was when Sipiwe Shabalala scored that goal for South Africa in the 55th minute. And here's what it sounded like in the square.
That's from Johannesburg. Stefan, did South Africa and Mexico, did the teams perform as expected?
You know, Mexico, I think, underperformed a little bit. They were favorites going into this game. In their group, Mexico, South Africa, Uruguay, and France, South Africa was not predicted to advance to the second round. So for South Africa, this was a heroic moment. They were completely dominated in the first half. In the second half, though, the South Africans played extremely well. And South Africa nearly won the game. About 3 minutes from the end, one of their players hit the post with a brilliant shot.
Okay, Stefan, we'll come back to you in a moment because we want to hear more from you about what's happening in the tournament.
Great, Robert.
And meanwhile, for a sense of the excitement here in this country, we stationed NPR's Mandalit Del Barco in Los Angeles with a group of Mexico supporters, and we sent NPR's Robert Smith to watch the game with some South Africans in New York City.
I'm Mandalit Del Barco in Los Angeles at the Plaza Mexico. It's a little replica of the Zocalo Plaza in Mexico City, and it's the next best thing to being there. You know, the fiesta here started at 4:30 in the morning. So many Mexican fans are here watching three jumbo screens. It's just a sea of red and green.
And I'm Robert Smith in New York City, in Hell's Kitchen to be exact. That sound you hear is, of course, the Vuvuzela, which means that I'm at a South African bar, not as easy to find as a Mexican gathering in Los Angeles. And the meal to eat this morning is Ostrich Benedict. And expatriates have gathered here to blow their horns and to cheer on the South African team.
In South Africa, our land.
Those high notes are a little bit hard to hit, aren't they?
Very odd.
Hey, Robert. It's way too loud over here. Hey, there's Mario Lopez, that teen idol with the incredible dimples. Let's go talk to him.
I'm excited to be here, and I love that, you know, thousands of people came out to support Mexico. The fact that it's 6 in the morning and all these people are here is awesome.
Al sonoro rugir de gallo.
Mendeley here in New York City with the South Africans. I have to say, it's not as much a party as it is kind of a tense gathering. You know, the host country has never lost an opening match in World Cup history. And people here, like Brett Curtin, who I was talking to, who's from Cape Town, they're kind of nervous about the way South Africa is going to appear to the entire world.
I guess it's a trepidation, and to have us eliminated early in the games would just be a disappointment to everybody, I'm sure, you know.
And Curtin's prediction for the final, South Africa versus England, a colonial rematch.
Mexico! Mexico! Mexico!
Viva Mexico! Viva Mexico! There's a lot of Mexican pride here.
South Africa scores and the place goes crazy. They almost knock over the table. Everyone's jumping up and down so much. I imagine things are a little more sober in Los Angeles.
Sober in Los Angeles. The people are on their sixth beer. They've been drinking since 4 a.m. Well, the final score was 1-1, a tie. The Mexican fans here in L.A. are a little bit less enthusiastic than before, but still they're celebrating with dancing, mariachis, and they're even kicking around soccer balls. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, at Plaza Mexico, outside of Los Angeles.
You know, it's funny, Mandalit, the South African fans here in New York City are actually pretty happy. They didn't want to become the first host nation to ever lose the opening game, and a draw is good enough for them. Robert Smith, NPR News in New York City with fans of Bafana Bafana.
Bafana, Bafana Bafana is the best team in the world.
Well, Stefan Fatsis joins us again now from South Africa. And Stefan, let's look ahead a bit. The U.S. opens its World Cup tomorrow against mighty England. Do the Americans have any chance at all?
Yeah, I think they do. I'll be driving up there to Rustenburg tomorrow morning to watch the game. And the Americans absolutely can compete against the best clubs in the world. They may not be at their level yet, but they certainly are in that second tier. And in soccer, anything can happen. We saw that South Africa-Mexico tie today was unexpected. The U.S. did announce today that Jozy Altidore, their striker, will start. He had been hurt for the last couple of weeks, and that's an important piece of news. The critical issue for the United States is going to be marking England's brilliant Wayne Rooney, their striker, their big goal scorer. The United States' big problem has been their back line of defense. This is going to be a huge challenge for them to stop Wayne Rooney. The United States has to avoid opening gaps in its defense that are a world-class player like Rooney can exploit.
Now, Stefan, explain how this tournament works. The U.S. and England are both in a group of four, together with Algeria and Slovenia. If the U.S. doesn't beat England, do they still have a chance of advancing out of that group of four?
Oh, absolutely. And I think most people aren't expecting them to beat England. There are 32 teams in the World Cup, and there are eight groups of four. The top two teams in each group will advance to this single elimination phase. So even if the United States doesn't win tomorrow, they could beat or will have to beat either Slovenia or Algeria and probably at least get a tie as well. So a tie tomorrow would be considered a huge advantage, a huge victory for the United States.
And what other games or storylines apart from the U.S. game will you be watching this weekend?
Well, I think I'll be watching whether some of the best players in the world are going to recover in time to play in their opening games. Didier Drogba of the Ivory Coast broke his arm in a friendly against Japan a week ago. He had surgery the next day. He has been working out, according to his coach, Sven-Goran Eriksson of the Ivory Coast, and he's going to practice but not experience any contact so that he doesn't bump his arm. We'll see if he's ready for Tuesday. The other great player that was hurt last week was the Netherlands winger, Ayn Robben. He's expected to join his team tomorrow. Unclear whether he's recovered from a hamstring injury and will be able to play on Monday against Denmark. The game of the weekend, though, in addition to the U.S. England, Argentina, Nigeria, that's going to be a fun one to watch.
Okay, Stefan, enjoy the weekend.
Thank you, Robert.
Our own Stefan Fatsis covering the World Cup soccer tournament in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Our series Setting Out has featured so many college graduates struggling to find jobs that it may be a bit of a relief to meet one young man in Ohio who can relax this summer. He has a degree from a top university, and he has a job lined up. Mari Saito of member station WCPN in Cleveland has the story of a new graduate who will soon start his career in business.
After graduating from Case Western Reserve University in May, 22-year-old Dwayne Pinder moved back home to Reynoldsburg, Ohio, a suburb of Columbus. His mom, Dora, quickly put him to work, dealing with one of the effects the recession has had on their family. The local school district is in financial trouble, and last year's failed school levy meant the end of bus service for its high schoolers.
So his sister, we had to transport to school. And so he's been doing the pickup every day.
He's used to it. I'm like a chauffeur, so.
Since graduation, Pinder has also been doing errands around the house and catching up with friends and family. One thing he's not doing is looking for a job. But he finds that when he tells people his post-graduation plans, the response is always the same.
Yeah, it's more like, you know, oh, so have you graduated? And I'm like, yes, you know, they're like, well, congratulations on graduating. They're like, well, do you know what you're going to do after? And, you know, I'm like, oh, well, I have a job in Cleveland. They're like, oh, you have a job. That's awesome.
Pinder initially dreamed of being an investment banker. And from his freshman year of college, he pursued that goal hard. He held internships at financial companies every summer, served as student body president, and made the dean's list. In the fall of 2007, he traveled to New York and toured Wall Street investment banks. But just a year later, the company where he hoped to work collapsed in the country's worst financial crisis since the Great Depression.
I wanted to work for Lehman Brothers, but then, you know, that kind of didn't happen. So it was just interesting because it was just like, you know, this was a career path that I wanted to go into and it's not there anymore.
After talking with college advisors, Pinder decided to look at management consulting firms. He soon found that for these companies, he had to relearn how to do a job interview.
They'll give you a business problem and kind of go through some iterations of, you know, what you think about the problem, how would you solve it if you had the information necessary. That's something I never did before. I did a lot of practice.
Hours and hours of practice. The work paid off, though. Dwayne Pinder got interviews with J.P. Morgan, Deloitte & Touche, and McKinsey & Company. He got offers from all three. Assistant Dean Jim Hurley advises Pinder and other business and economics majors at Case. In the current job market, Hurley says students have to start working toward their career goals early.
When you think about Dwayne, you have to remember that, I mean, he didn't start his job search in his senior year. I mean, he was very career-focused when he came into the university, and he's one of our top, very, very best and brightest. And I think that his experiences, the Case Western Reserve name, opened a lot of doors. But there were students who found things tougher this year.
In a few weeks, Dwayne Pinder will start his professional career as a business analyst at McKinsey & Company. Dwayne credits his mom, Dora, for helping him stay focused on the future. Dora says there are jobs out there, but graduates looking for work have to be creative and persistent.
I tell people this all the time, go out and volunteer and get something on your resume. You're not doing anything anyway, so just unique things to market yourself. And so they will get jobs eventually.
And if anyone is proof that strategy works, even in these tough times, it's Dwayne Pinder. For NPR News, I'm Mari Saito in Cleveland.
The writer Clay Shirky has been monitoring the free time we have in our lives. And over the past several decades, he says we've spent a lot of that time doing just one thing.
Television became essentially an unpaid half-time job for every man, woman, and child in the developed world, right? 25 hours a week or so, times a couple billion people.
New research shows the internet is eating up more and more of our TV watching time.
Clay Shirky writes about this sea change in his new book, Cognitive Surplus.
A cognitive surplus is my phrase for the cumulative time and talents of the networked world, because we're all networked together. We can share things. We can take on projects larger than what one person can do in their basement. And so the cognitive surplus is the reason we have, you know, billions of photos on Flickr and 24 hours a day of video being uploaded every minute on YouTube. It's the reason we have Wikipedia and open source software. The amount of time and talent we have to swing to shared problems and civic action is incredibly vast.
But there's also a lot of cute kitty sites on the web.
The internet is fueled by cute cats, yeah.
And in fact, I can waste just as much time looking at cute kitty sites as I ever could watching sitcoms. So what's the balance?
Right. But the interesting thing about lolcats, about these cute cats made cuter with the application of cute captions, is that when you see a lolcat, you get a second message, which is you could play this game too. Right? When you see something on television, the message is, you could not do this. You can only consume this. There is a giant gulf between doing something and doing nothing. And someone who makes a lolcat and uploads it, even if only to crack their friends up, has already crossed that chasm to doing something. That's the sea change. And you can see it even with the cute cats.
And I see it in a very nice anecdote that you have in your book about a little girl who's watching a video. Mm. And she gets up off the couch and she goes to the back of the TV. Yeah. And her father thinks, oh, she wants to see the characters and see where they are. But what she's looking for is the mouse. It's inconceivable to this four-year-old that you can have television that you can't interact with.
I mean, you see this with kids. I see this with my kids all the time. They'll see a screen out in public, and they go up and they touch it because they assume that it's going to respond to them. People who are used to those opportunities will both look for them when they're young, but I'm also imagining will design around them when they're older. When they come to start making media, they're going to start assuming that other people will have some kind of input as well.
There's always a list of losses that accompanies
yes.
any new technology, and there is a cottage industry of hand-wringers.
More than a cottage industry, let me tell you.
And let me give yeah. them their voice. One is vanishing attention span. Deep right. reading is right. gone. Social right. polarization.
Right. The social polarization one is, in my mind, the most interesting. Cass Sunstein kicked this off with Republic.com and the worry about the echo chamber. What's so interesting now, though, about the echo chamber is that the political movement in the United States that is, in a way, most consistently creating an environment where the opinions are internally consistent and resistant to dialogue is the Tea Party. And yet, the Tea Party is characterized by the people who grew up in the old media landscape. The Tea Party is one of the few protest movements in the U.S. not driven by teenagers and people in their early 20s.
But I am told that they wouldn't exist without an internet way.
Oh, no, of course.
Everybody
uses the internet all the time. Even the hand-wringers use the internet. The interesting thing to me about the echo chamber argument is that it actually seems to have been a description not of the internet, but rather of the world of three television stations and one local newspaper, which is to say the media landscape of the 20th century, with its incredible paucity of sources, created more of an echo chamber than what we're seeing today.
You document some important social networks. There's one in Kenya that mapped information like election violence, and it actually helped people stay away from places that they could get hurt. There's a website called Patients Like Me where people share their symptoms and actually improve care for patients. When you look on balance at this evolving landscape, do you see more patients like me than lolcats in a way that you can tell which way it's going?
Well, I don't believe there's a which way question. We don't actually have to choose. We can have both lolcats of the cute cats. And we can have patients like me. Let me bring out Harvey Suedos, who's an American novelist, and I quote him in the book, who said in the middle of last century, you know, are paperback books going to flood the market with trash, or are they going to mean that we have access to the classics? And the answer to that question, of course, was why pick? Right? The abundance of paperback books meant we could have all of both. So I don't think there's a trade-off between how many lolcats and how many patients like me sites are there. I think the trade-off is how well are we going to support things like patients like me, which are trying to transform medical research culture. So the thing we need to be concentrating on is finding the people who are going after creating civic value and helping them, regardless of the entertainment value of the cute cats.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Clay Shirky teaches at the Interactive Telecommunications Program at New York University. His new book is called Cognitive Surplus.
Well, of course, we reached out to Facebook and Twitter to find out what you had to say about your cognitive surplus.
One comment came from Greg Coulter. When I write anything or take pictures or make movies, it's almost with the intent of posting it on the internet.
Kathy Swink writes that the internet has inspired her to get more creative in the kitchen.
She says TV cooking shows are too slow for her taste, and they don't offer tips and tweaks from others.
Pete Mortensen says the internet has made him more, quote, fake productive. You can communicate with our incredibly productive staff at Morning Edition's Facebook page or on Twitter at Morning Edition or at NPR Inskeep. Our program is directed by Van Williamson and Lindsay Totti. The production staff includes Claudette Heberman, Steve Monroe, Vince Pearson, Leah Scarpelli, Selena Simmons-Duffin, Joanna Stein, Travis Larchuk, and Chris Benderev, with Ben Bergman and Melissa Yeager-Miller at NPR West. Our executive producer is Metallica Sicka.
The executive director of news programming is Ellen McDonnell. Morning Edition's theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Deborah Amos, in for Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Summer is usually a time when moviegoers look for escapism, not reality. But from now to Labor Day, theaters look to be packed with documentaries, 21 by our count, 8 this month alone. Among them, Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. Bob Mondello has our review.
The film opens with a lingering shot you probably don't expect, an enormous full-screen close-up of Joan Rivers without makeup. Veins spidery, skin blotchy, upper lip frozen, eyebrows so thin you can count every hair. It's a declaration of intent that this picture will not just be about surfaces. Then she slathers on foundation, lipstick, mascara thick as paste, and younger images start appearing as shadows, along with voices from her past.
Would you welcome Miss Joan Rivers? You know, you're going to be a big star.
Now here's my daffy little friend, Joan Rivers.
By the end of the accolades, she's fully made up, the Joan Rivers we know, ready to talk trash, but first having to wade through trash, down stairwells piled high with junk, to backstage hallways with peeling paint, onto a tiny, dilapidated stage.
This is my career. I mean, how depressing is this? 40 years in the business, and this is where you end up.
At 77, Rivers doesn't play Vegas as often as she once did, but there's still a Joan Rivers industry headquartered in her wildly Baroque Manhattan apartment. Gold, white, pink. This, she says, is how Marie Antoinette would have lived if she'd had money. In her office is a sort of joke museum, a wall of alphabetized card catalog drawers stuffed with 3x5 cards, each one typed neatly with a gag she's delivered, often to outrage, especially back in the days when female comics were expected to be demure.
You know how lousy you feel at night when I'm undressed, my husband looks at me and mentally dresses me? You know how lousy I can be?
When I started comedy, I was very wild for the time, but different times. The last line of my original act was, this business, it's all about casting couches, so I just want you to know my name's Joan Rivers, and I put out. It's such a sweet little silly line from a girl who was 28 years old, you know, dressed up, trying to look nice. The audience, half of them laughed. Jack Lemmon saw me and walked out. Said, that's disgusting. So for my time, I was very shocking.
Shocking played well as late night fare, of course, and for a time, Joan was the late night queen, anointed by the king himself.
Don't you think men really like intelligence more when it comes right down to it?
Ah, please, are we going to go back to that? Are you kidding?
Sure, I mean, it's a brain, you know, a caring person.
No man has ever put his hand up a woman's dress looking for a library card.
Rivers became Johnny Carson's designated replacement host, but when she took a late-night gig on a rival network, Carson never spoke to her again. Her show was a flop, her husband felt responsible and committed suicide, and her struggle to rebuild took decades. As the film repeatedly makes clear, comedy is a high-wire act where you're forever in danger of crashing.
Oh, I hate children. The only child that I think I would have liked ever was Helen Keller, because she didn't talk. And it's just... Yes, it is. And if you don't, then leave.
It's funny if you have a deaf son.
I happen to have a deaf mother. Oh, you stupid... Let me tell you what comedy is.
How she gets the audience laughing again, I'll leave you to discover for yourself. Suffice it to say, she doesn't get any less abrasive or less self-absorbed. But as the film demonstrates, there is more to this particular hard-charging, egomaniacal joke machine than gets revealed on stage. Plastic surgery, vulgarity, red carpet chats, all just small pieces of Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. I'm Bob Mondello.